great pleasure to hand the meeting over to Michael.
Hi everyone, I'm Michael, I'm an addict.
Hi Michael.
I appreciate the opportunity to come and share with you this evening. I need to just get over myself around the mic. I don't really like mics. Kind of hearing myself here, having to remind myself I haven't been nicked. This isn't an interview. We're okay, you're amongst friends. I don't speak for Narcotics Anonymous. I'd only like to just take opportunity to share my experience as I've found it since finding this this fellowship. You know, I do want to express that you know, I am an advocate for recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. I do believe that that recovery is possible in Narcotics Anonymous, and my experience is it's an absolutely amazing program, fellowship, news guys, you know, and I'm totally indebted to you. So I'd like to thank Michael there for asking me to come and do the share here this evening. You know, I need to say just where I am at the moment as well. You know, to all intents and purposes, I'm in a really good place at the moment. You know, in myself. You know, I come to Narcotics Anonymous on the 19th of January 2003. So that means I've been clean just over 10 years. And I want to share my experiences around that, and I take no credit for it other than putting in the work, I guess. But maybe over the next kind of 30, 40 minutes, I can try and incorporate and express something about grace, and I don't mean religion, I mean grace and change and relationships. You know, the reason I'm saying all that now at the beginning is it's been quite a day, man. I've been on the and I'm not a guy that goes to me and just talking about my day, you'd be pleased to know, but today's been an unusual day. I've been on the go since 6:15. My mum 3 weeks ago, and I'm a bit of a mother's boy, my mum 3 weeks ago was diagnosed with lung cancer, and it's metastatic. That means that it's moved, and it's now potentially terminal brain cancer. And that's just so obviously that means a lot. The amazing fact is I know, and I mean know, Jay, in my heart of hearts, a drug isn't the answer. I'm a million miles away from that. I know that. I know that. But what's amazing for me is I've just spent 6-7 hours with my mum on dialysis, preparing her for treatment, speaking to consultants, and had a few moments. I think one was she just rubbed my hand, and that was a very special moment. There was a couple in the eye as well. And that's amazing, you know, and it was never anything like that, you know. So I wanted to say that from the start, because that's where I am. I'd like to suggest I was spiritually maladjusted long before I picked up a substance. Long before, you know. You would have picked up from my accent that I come from the East End of London. Okay. My parents were publicans. I just need to call it how it is. It doesn't make, as you said, it doesn't make me an addict, but it does shape the man I am and the man that I was to become. I was raised in gangland London. Okay, my dad was a pavement worker. That doesn't mean that he worked for Murphy's. Okay, it means that he was an armed robber. That's who my dad was, and he was a very well-respected, powerful figure that demanded respect in any room that he walked into, and we grew up very much around that. Again, I stress, doesn't make me an addict. And we picked up all the kind of good stuff that you pick up within there, you know, kind of, I think, which is quite ironic, really, that I'm here kind of sharing quite openly this evening, because I come from a place where you tell no one nothing. Absolutely nothing. You know, we sometimes have this yellow card, you know, who you see here, when you leave here, let's stay here. I think they got that from my mum. Straight. because that's what she used to tell us. With severe repercussions, you know, as long as the nets were nice and the doorstep was clean, we was okay, you know, sort of thing. So I grew up with all these guys, you know, this social conditioning, as it were, trust no one. You know, you can't trust no one, especially women. It's a dog-eat-dog world. Get them before they get you. You know, it's them and us. You know, really good for building the trust and the esteem, you know, that sort of stuff. You know, doesn't make me an addict, but shape the man that I was to become. I'm going to kind of go on the fence with what I'm going to say now. You know, we talk about, you know, I was really kind of fearful as a child and all that sort of stuff. I'm on the fence with that. On one hand, I was kind of anxious or uncomfortable in socially demanding situations. On the other, the reality is I was a latchkey kid. What that means is I grew up on a council estate in the Roman Road Market. I don't know if any of you older ladies used to be shopping down the Roman, or maybe the blokes a bit of kiting, who knows. But I grew up there, and, you know, I'd be on the roofs, you know, I could engage with, you know, the other kids. So not completely fearful, and I was kind of a light kid, you know, the kids liked me, they wanted to hang about with me most some, but so I wasn't kind of lacking in that area. I'm the youngest of six, okay, and that was it. And our kind of my childhood was no really different from anyone else where I lived. My dad, when I was a very young boy, he got 13 years for the Bank of Cyprus. I don't know if any of you older ones remember G. Davis is Innocent campaign. And my dad got 13 years for that. That's important because what that dictated was for the following 9 years, my dad was a Category A prisoner, and what that meant was most Sundays mum would scrape up us children, and we'd be following her to places like Longlaughlin, Franklin, Parkhurst, some of these places, some of you may know, you know, and there'd be the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, one of the twins, and that. And I kind of grew up very much around that. And I remember even as a young boy, I used to sit there, I thought, I can't wait to get in here. You know, and I'd be bounced around the kind of visit room. All right, boy, how's your boxing? All right, sound good, you little shit. And, you know, I know I've got quite a hefty amount of time here, probably too much, but in the interest of time, I won't give you the I could have been a contender story, okay? Otherwise, we're never going to get out of here. So. But how it went for me was sport was an outlet for me. It was an escape, and I threw myself into kind of boxing from a very, very, very young age, like 5, 6 we was into boxing, and I stayed there for a very, very kind of long time, and it was my outlet. It's what I'd done. I was obsessive, I was excessive around it. You know, I used to watch like the Hagler and Simpson's fights like loads of times, you know, all them kind of fights there, Rocky, all the time. Mum would go, come on, Mike, it's dinner time. I did it for you, Adrian. All that sort of stuff. Yeah. I'd be up in the morning, you know, I'd be slipping into the black bag and eating them disgusting raw eggs and running around Vicky Park. What was I doing with a black bag? I was about as thick as a rasher of bacon. And that's how it was. But as I said, you know, and it was great. It was a great escape. But it was a great escape, you know, and it served that purpose. It's ironic, you know, because I can feel quite self-conscious, not too much, but quite self-conscious coming here sharing openly with you. But walk me to a ring where, you know, plenty of people are cheering to get me weighed in, and I'd be, you know, in my element. And that's kind of how it stayed. I liked what you said about kind of about prayer, because this is important as well. Around the age 7 or 8, I don't need to get into too much of the particulars, but I remember as a young kid praying to a God that I didn't understand. and I had some really kind of unreasonable requests, but I was a young boy, hot tears under the pillows, and I used to say, no, stop this, I'll make that happen, I'll bring Dad home, you know. And I remember this time, I remember exactly, I can see myself now, and I remember it never happened because it wasn't going to happen. And I renounced any concept of a higher power, and from age 7 or 8 I started running my life from that point. Fact. So schooling wasn't bad. Second school, you know, I was starting to come known to professionals. I like to tell a story, you know, when you start getting known to all services and that, you know, of an incident with a psychiatrist and kind of went, or children's services psychologist, and kind of went, you know, I'd like you to peel this orange. Yeah, well. And I was that kind of arrogant. I'd say, I'll peel it if you eat it. Do you know what I mean? But it was exactly the answer they wanted. Do you know? And I remember going to secondary school, and I remember walking in there, and again, I'm going to put this into the spiritual malady, you know, kind of that fear. I remember walking in Morpeth School, Bethnal Green, walked in there. It was too loud, it was too big, and there was too many people in it, you know. And I was out that back door, man. And it was, again, doesn't make me... and there's a standing joke in my family. My mum would drop me at the front gate and I'd be home, you know. And it was their fault, they left the gate open. And that was it, you know, truancy. So I was into the boxing, kind of into sport, that was an outlet, and that's where I was. And it seems to go like this, there's probably more to it, but the narrative for me goes along these lines. I was into my sport, I boxed right up to late teens, and then I discovered substances and girls at the same time. And then life was to change for me. You know, it's a choice I made, and I remember my trainer at that time, Mickey Quinn, was a lovely man. And I remember Mickey saying, that's as far as we can go, man. Got to let you go, kid. And I was using substances on resentment right from that start. You know, blame and sort of stuff. Why is that important? That's important because I was 20 years old. Okay. Wasn't a particularly bad kid. You know, I had a real hatred for authority. An internalised hatred for authority, but I picked it up along the way. So age 20, life changes. By age 21, I've been in the Young Offenders Institution 3 times as a direct result of my substances. You know, because I've never been able to control and moderate once I start. Never. Some people say, you know, I had this period, it was fine, crossed the line, visible line, and then it went downhill. It was chaos from the start for me. Just for me. I only share my experiences. Never been able to control and moderate once I start. Never been able to turn it off. You know, don't seem to have an off switch, you know, and then we accumulate kind of too many consequences. So I was to turn up Young Offenders Institution, felt at the time, and Felton, you know, some of you would have been there, you know, kind of back in the day, when Felton was kind of, that's a horrible place to be. 1 minute kind of I'm home, next minute I'm on a landing, because this is my experience, where young men like me are crying themselves to sleep and others hanging themselves. You know, and if ever I was kind of pleased, I'd learnt a few boxing skills and running skills along the line. It was in film, and that was to set the stage, my friends. It embarrasses me to tell you a bit, but that was to set the stage of my story. You know, it goes downhill from here. They talk about, you know, this illness, the illness of addiction, being progressive. I suggest digressive. You know, and you know. And that was the way it had to go. And it was kind of one more attempt and one more failure and stuff. And around that time, kind of 21, 22, and I'm at the Sugar Daddy's prisons now, yeah? Don't drop the soap, whatever you do. So I'm in Sugar Daddy's prisons now, and I remember a situation. I bring Mum back in. I remember Mum coming up to a visit, broken. And I remember... And the hot tears again, and they're looking at me and saying, sort it out. Come on now. You know, if you can't do it for them, do it for them, do it for your son, do it. And I remember, maybe you can connect with it, and I remember saying, you know, I was crying, man. You know, I was broken, I was connected. And I said, I will. I will. And I meant it with every fibre of my body. I meant it. As we come to know, addiction is a hopeless condition of mind and body. Crux of the problem setting is in the mind. And I remember walking out of that particular establishment, them doors opening with that resolve. And as them doors opened, so did that resolve. And I said, you know what, I'll just have one on the way home. Just one. Just one. And that set off that same kind of, because I've learned that here, it's the first one that does the damage. Didn't know that. I've learned that. You guys have taught me that. And I had a son at that time. I was absolutely poxy at it. He's 22 years old now. I have a beautiful relationship with him. But, for the first 5 years of his life, I was just in addiction. And it was, as our reading says, jails, institutions, all that sort of stuff there, Jay. One more attempt, one more failure, tried the geographicals, always looking for an external solution to an internal problem, always. Finally, I changed the place, changed the people, throw money at it. Do this, do that, to an internal problem, heroin. Let's talk about heroin, because heroin has become a big part of my story, heroin was frowned upon, as we all know. It was absolutely frowned upon, I had a family member, my brother-in-law was on it for a very long time, before me, my cousins, but I was nowhere near it, And I was coming to the end of a 4 year prison sentence for the consequence of my addiction. And I received another 3.5 years on top at that time. And I remember walking back into that cell and I said, give me some of that. Give me some of that here. And, I use substances. I didn't use substances for childhood trauma, man. I use substances for the effects that substances produce. And I ain't choosing. I'll go up, I'll go down, I'll go right the way you want to go it, I'm not choosy in that way. But once I've got it, I'm on it, I'm on it, and I'm keeping it, and I'm, and heroin, man, what an amazing kind of, Crikey O'Reilly. What a promise. God, I promise. I remember about 2 of them years after that. And from promises, and just took away the wings, man, and then I got a habit. And then, as heroin does. And I remember a visit, I was in Wayland Prison, I remember my dad coming up to that. And he was quite straight talk, as I've suggested. I remember my dad coming up and saying, along the lines, I won't swear. But where do you think you are, Butlins? About £50 here and £50 there and £50 there to your mum and the ducking and the diving. He said, don't think we don't know what you're doing. He said, don't worry about the heroin killing, it will kill you. It went one ear and out the other. Because by that time, I'm now a heroin addict, man. And it's got me, and I come out of more geographical kind of solutions, and the road gets narrower, doesn't it, Jake? Mm. And addiction, man, the road gets narrower, and I come out there, and kind of crack becomes part of my story. Intravenous using, becomes a part of my story, and no life, lost life, man. Wasn't even living by the 24-hour clock anymore. It's a night owl. No way. Desperate. Not a bad guy. But just, drugs had hold of me. And we go where we go, with all that stuff. And my family kind of disown me. And and I've become kind of just desperate, just desperate. I don't want to trigger anyone here. I just want to talk about where, when, you know, when intravenous using. You know, I've recently realised I'm kind of Hep C positive. I'm about to start the treatment on that, you know, and talk about digression. You know, injecting in the neck, injecting all the veins gone. And I was just reminded recently, you know, when you're looking in the mirror and you're thinking, that one above the eyelid can go. What a desperate place to be. I'm going to start moving this on. My second from last year's up was again, it just got just desperate, you know. You know when you get to Finsbury Park, you know you're in trouble, don't you? Do you know what I mean? I'm in trouble now, I'm Finsbury Park. I'm like, shit, man, I want to check out, man, what's going on here? And stuff, and some more kind of stuff around that. I kind of won't go into the details of that, and I end up arrested for attempted murder times two. And I spent 10 months... pretty much in segregation on that, and that's when I just felt like an animal, man, you know. And I was in the seg, and I had a bed that was cemented to the floor, cardboard table, cardboard chair. They feed me two man unlocked like an animal. And you ever heard the saying, for a wing and a prayer? Let me tell you something. So I was in that moment, because that's how I come to Narcotics Anonymous. I was on that wing, and I used to say my legal representative, my legal aid solicitor, come up and went, look, you know, this and that's going to happen. You're going home. Right, you're going home. And then she looked at me and said, didn't you hear what I just said? You're going home. And my heart had sunk, because I didn't want to come home. And I asked you, what sort of man doesn't want to come home from that? But I knew where things was going to go. And just like yourself there, you know, kind of I went back to that cell and I hit my knees and I said, please, help me. And I'm not a man of religion, I'm a Jew. Okay? But I went back to that God that I renounced, age seven, and said, either give me the power to do something about it or the power to end it. You know, I can't go on anymore. Won't go on. And it was the most honest kind of prayer that I'd ever said. And I've stuck by that prayer from that day to this. And this is where this story gets better, you'd be pleased to know. You know, and that's why I incorporated the word grace. You know, 2 weeks later, I'm sitting in the meeting of Narcotics Anonymous amongst you guys. You know. And I'm totally indebted to you guys. I'm totally indebted to the guys that slid up beside me, even though I had them eyes that said, go away. You know, and said, you know, if drugs are your problem, you're in the right place. Welcome. You know, we laugh about it, but it's true. Keep coming back. No one was telling me to keep coming back. They'd say, go away, come here, call the police. Keep coming back. Touch me, man. I know where else to go. Kind of touch me. You know. And I love the fact that you guys never sugarcoated it. You know, that you guys kind of stood up behind me and said, recovery is possible in Narcotics Anonymous, but there is work to be done. You know, we have a recovery program. And, you know, and that sort of stuff. We have the meetings. We have service. You know, and that sort of stuff. You know, and... I have to just plug the Brixton meeting on Sunday night, you know, it just blew me away. I see people standing up for these kind of years and months and stuff like that, and I listen to you guys, and I listen to your stories, and you blew me away. And do you know what? I've pretty much done step one before I come here, although I'll talk more about that. But I've come to believe, you know, through your testimonies, through your kind of what you shared here, and I've always believed, and I still believe, that there's something. This fellowship is blessed. Can't explain it, man, but there's something special goes on here. You know, how does a wretch like me come in here, you know, come to believe, you know, do some work on myself, and stay sober for 10.5 years? The fact is, I couldn't even get home with, you know, staying clean from the train station. And I just think this stuff's powerful, man. And there's a lot of power here. And I know there's some new people here, and I really hope you find that, you know. And if you're new, when I done, just threw myself into meetings. You know, first, I threw myself into meetings, you know. And we're blessed, aren't we? You know, we've got so many meetings in kind of... And getting meetings like this, you know, a lot of organisation goes into meetings like this, you know, and kind of stick with the winners or win with the stickers, whatever way you want to kind of look at that sort of stuff. But, you know, I had a period of kind of abstinence in them earlier days, and it was just great. It just kind of held me, and it was just beautiful. But, you know, I have a disease of addiction. And the crux of it centres in my mind, you know. And... just because I walked over the threshold didn't mean he was going to leave it alone, leave me alone. So I was just about for a few weeks, you know, and kind of my disease was, Mike, come on, man, this is a bit drastic, isn't it? You know, come on, we've got time to make up here. Well, you seem very pleased with these guys. You know, I was like, crap, I'm going to use again. I'm here and I'm going to use. It ain't if, it's when. It was never if. It was always when. It was always when. And that scared me, man. And I'll confess, I have a healthy fear of using today. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about that. Because I know. I understand. I've done enough work on myself to understand why it's the first one that does the damage. I know I can't use. Whether today's a good day, a bad day, or somewhere in between. Because I'm powerless, man. Once I pick up, it's like Pringles. Once I pop that top, we're off. You know, it is. You know, I don't know. If I had the power of choice... Now, I remember a fellow once, you know, going back to the earlier days. I was thinking about him the other day. You know, I remember being in a toilet and was passing the wraps and something happened and he went, I've still got this from last week. I was like, what? You loon. Yeah. You know, that's not my experience. You know, I can't even hold a bit of gear till the next morning. And I know that. You know. But what I learned is, it doesn't have to be like that. You know, I strongly believe that we never need to use again. Never. So long as we kind of do what we need to do. But at that time, I nearly used, and or at least the kind of mind was back on me, the obsession. And one thought overrides every other one. And I was looking at the door handle again, and I got honest. And I went to a man, and I said, I'm half out the door. You know, I might have two or three service positions here, and I can quote all that stuff on the wall. You know, I used to go around, it works if you work it. I didn't know what worked, how you worked it. You know, I had all the service positions, you know, I had all the kind of clubber lined up at home and all that sort of stuff. Looking for that external solution to an internal problem. And I nearly used. And he said to me, Mike, there's more to Narcotics Anonymous than what you're doing. You know. He says, you know, you need to go down and start to think about doing a bit of work now. You know. What does that mean? You need to get yourself a sponsor, go through the program. You know. It's what we have. You know. Doesn't make sense to go to a 12-step fellowship and not do the 12 steps. It's like going to a baker's and not buying bread. What are you doing in the baker's? You know, it's what we have. 12-step recovery program for addiction. You know, and what a beautiful suggestion. You know, and I slid up to what was to be my home group at that time. You know, which is very similar to this. You know, I've always kept good company in Narcotics Anonymous, and. I met a man that evening who was about 10 years clean and sober at that time, and he spoke, I guess, the language of the art, you know? Mm. The therapeutic value of 183 to her. And he'd been everywhere I'd been, but he had over 10 years clean at that time. And he blew me away. Blew me away. A very loving man, very spiritual man. I've never been told what to do in Narcotics Anonymous, you know? I've been shown, guided. You know, even now, you know, kind of held, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, and I said about, you know, give me some kind of, you know, daily action plan, if you like, you know, some things that he done, you know, to stay clean and sober on a daily basis, and I incorporated that. You know, I've got a home groups of service, you know, committed to something, you know, and set about kind of going through the reading the literature and set about kind of going about that. And we stopped off and, you know, I believe, and I don't speak for Narcotics Anonymous, I believe that this program starts with honesty and ends with service. What do I mean? What I mean is it starts with honesty around our powerlessness. Until we get honest around our addiction, we can't really do much else. One of you said it in a reading, you know, it's the honesty. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take a certain step. You said that. Someone said it off the floor. It's the honesty. You know, and I wanted it, man, because you've got, you know, I was sold. You know, and I got in touch with my own powerlessness. The fact that I can't control and moderate once I start, never have been able to, and you know what? Never will. If I could control and moderate once I start, I wouldn't be here. I'd be out there controlling and moderating once I start and probably telling someone else my story. Fact. Yeah. And work on my kind of unmanageability, accepting my powerlessness. How are we doing for time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, thank you. And then I moved on. And as I said, come to believe. I believe there's a number of powers in this fellowship. There's the power of the program, the power of the fellowship, and there's the higher power. So a lot of powers. You know, I've gone from powerlessness to, you know, I can potentially be empowered here. And you know, I've stopped to look at the mind, the insidious insanity of the mind, you know, the lie, the con, the belief, and at this time it'll be different. So here's how, you know, and I kind of having step one, you know, step one for me looked at the physical, step two looked at the mental, step three was about the spiritual, you know. And in step three, I made a decision to do what you guys have done, what you showed me, those that had what I want. You know, I don't want physical abstinence. You can keep physical abstinence. I want emotional recovery. In the mind. I believe addiction centers in the mind and recovery centers in the mind. You know, so kind of, you know, straightened up, not just physically, but mentally and spiritually. And I made an honest step three, influenced by the prayer in the cell. You know, so it kind of worked for me. And in my home group, they used to say, "How do you know, Mike, if I've done step three? You've got a pen in your hand, you're doing step four." That's how you know. It's a decision that requires action. Okay? And I've done a step four. And I toyed with the idea of leaving them out. I swore I'd never share them with anyone. Irrespective of that sick of your secrets. But I got honest. I built a relationship with this sponsor. And I said, "There's some stuff I don't want to share with you, man." I never come to Narcotics Anonymous because I was personality of the year. You know, I've done some stuff. And, you know, he said, "Mike, you know, some people hold on to the worst ones and step and then go back out again. Tough to you, man. Call yours, brother." You know, and so I've done that and I threw them in there and they went there and I shared it with him in what's called a fifth step. And those that have done a fifth step know what I'm talking about. It was the most kindest thing I could ever do to myself. You know, I shared it with him, you know. You know, we hear about, you know, there's no flashing white lights and like, well, they're done promised. But what I got was kind of freedom from that stuff. I used to suffer badly from night tremors. Before I used to go to bed, every night, half hour before the DVD would go on. "Oh, yeah, I should have moved to the left on that one. Oh, yeah, an 84. Yeah, yeah, shouldn't have. If only I've got there a bit later." You know, that sort of stuff there. And I shared that stuff. I mean, it don't plague me today. Step six and seven, from doing four and five, and around change. For me. You've heard the story of the drunken horse thief? Sobers up, still a horse thief. You know, I needed to work with a horse thief in me. The thief in me. The perpetrator in me. You know, the distrusting. You know, the controlling. Six and seven, I continue to do that. And steps eight and nine, for me, to start rounding this up, are the most beautiful steps. steps 8 and 9. Step 8, allow me to become accountable. Man, they allow me to become responsible for some of that stuff that I've done. And I'll tell you now, guys, I won't microwave through the program. Ding! No. You know, my amends went over 5 years. I didn't delay, but that's how long some of them took. You know, and with my son and things like that. And I went and made amends, not for forgiveness. I went and made amends because it was the right thing to do. Because it was the right thing, because I've become accountable and responsible. And they, you know, beautiful amends, man. Beautiful amends. And I forgot to say earlier, my mum, through my using, was a recluse. For 2 years, she wouldn't leave the house because she was waiting for that call. You know that call? Mm-hmm. You know. And that was just the start of my amends. My amends are still ongoing. My amends are still in play today. And we went like that. You know, my amends still stands to the fact that I will walk my mum through every day of her treatment. And I was born in her arms, and if it's God's will that she dies in mine, then that's how it'll be. Step 8 and 9, been able to make amends. You know, my perspective, my outlook on life had changed at that point. I thought, hang on, he might just stay clean, pal. 10, 11 and 12, in the interest of time, maintenance. The maintenance, all I think all we really have is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual condition. Today. Right here, right now. The fact is, you have to have a spiritual condition in the first place. Step 10, 11 and 12, clean house, trust God, help others. Help them through sponsorship, help them through service, carry the message, take them through the program. You know, the program, not Michael's program, the program. Carry the message. It's what we got, man. Just like it was carried to me by you. I've been blessed. Relationships. Friendships. Still ongoing. I've got married since I've been in recovery. Got 2 young children. Went and done some training. Stay clean. Life has just grown all the way through. I'm going to say it because it's my experience. I left school age 13, as I said to you. Couldn't even spell my second name. Learned how to read in prison. Okay? Just about to start a doctorate. Go figure, man. From use. Gone off of it. It's always about the new guy or lady. If you're new here, you know, recovery is possible in Narcotics Anonymous. Fact. I know it is. But there is work to be done. Thanks for letting me share. All right.